This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and Professor Gary Marcus is with me today. He's a psychology researcher who runs the Center for Language and Music at New York University. He's also the author of the book Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. So that seems like a properly modest conclusion where Dr. Lim says this is what creativity looks like in solo jazz improvisation. Is it your hunch that if you were hooked up to an fMRI when you're playing the guitar, or I was hooked up to an fMRI when I'm writing, that those signatures would look different?
I would certainly expect that there are different signatures for different kinds of creative expression. I would even wonder whether if you did the same study slightly differently, whether you could actually get the same signature. So the truth is that when people run multiple fMRI studies of particular phenomena, there are even slight differences, they often get different results. So when you hear one study, you need to kind of hold on to your wallet and say, well, does this replicate? What if we change it in a slight way? What if someone is doing jazz improvisation not with a keyboard but with a guitar? What if they're playing in a different scale? So this was in the major scale. What if we played in the minor scale? What if we did it early in the morning versus late at night?
Right.
There are a million possibilities. And generally what we found is we do replications of fMRI studies is you do multiple studies. They don't always all point in the same direction. So I would take that result as a really good piece of pioneering work, but not the last word. That's the first thing I would say. And then the second thing I would say is, yeah, it's going to depend, even within jazz, it's going to depend on what process you're going through. What I liked about that study is trying to have a baseline where there's something that's not creative at all. Just play the C major scale in time with the metronome. And then there's this place where you play an improvisation. But that improvisation is relatively kind of limited in a way. It's you've got these notes with this particular backing track. And in the world of improvisation, it's a sort of narrow possibility. And you might say, well, what if I said you can play in modes, you can shift between scales? What if I said I want you to riff on this melody that I'm going to play first? And so there's a whole world of improvisation, and that's only looking at a tiny piece of it. Of course, the studies are expensive, and
right.
You know, not blaming Professor Lim for not having done all of these studies all in the first day.
Right.
But ultimately, to develop a research program, you need to try many different possibilities before you can conclude with confidence.
It's also interesting to me that the distinction in a neural imaging way between memory and expression. And then that leads me to wonder, well, when I memorized a song as a 10-year-old piano player or trumpet player, that presumably would look different on the fMRI than, you know, Glenn Gould's signature when he, you know, played Bach by memory.
Well, that's a really deep question. So memory is a really important part of improvisation. So when you construct an improvisation, the whole is obviously supposed to be new. But studies suggest that a lot of times there are a lot of pieces. There are little riffs in there and parts of scales and so forth that are old. And when you're using things that are old, you're going through your memory. So probably even when you're doing the most crazy improvisation, there's a huge demand on the brain's memory systems. It's just you're using it in a different way than if you were playing a rehearsed
right.
piece.
I was also really interested in this idea that Professor Lim seems to be going toward of this, that significantly creative expression is about inhibition and disinhibition. What's your experience of that, either as a guitar player or a writer or as a research scientist?
One of the first things I learned as a writer was what's called free writing, where you just basically throw everything down on a page and don't worry about it. And then you go back and revise and, you know, you try to shape it into a structure and so forth. And one of the skills that develops is that you can actually start to combine those processes a little bit. So you can do that free part and at the same time kind of automatically realize, you know, the grammatical structures you want, vary the rhythms of the sentences and try to make the topic information come closer to the beginning and so forth. So in the abstract, idealized way that a beginner does these things, they're really well-defined stages that are separate in time. But as you get good at them, you're actually combining all
right.
of these things in the same moment. And
right.
it becomes harder and harder for the neuroscientist to peel them apart. But you really want to actually be able to do them all at once. So
you know there is no bad idea. Yes, there is. That idea is bad. That idea is bad. And that all happens in a half a second.
That's right. And like you get the idea that you want to put down on the page. And when you're a good writer, this sort of grammar follows with it. Originally, you have the idea and then the grammar comes afterwards. And this notion of automaticity, that you get better at things by being able to do them automatic with less attention, means you can do more things at once you've practiced them enough to be solid.
In that piece, Professor Lim and the player that was tested both speculated about creativity medicines in the future. which led me to wonder, well, is that why so many artists and musicians drink a lot and get high?
Totally. And it probably works sometimes and not others. We do have people already trying to use performance-enhancing drugs in their cognitive domains. Coffee is a performance-enhancing drug. The one the military is working on, and I actually know a professional academic who plays around with this stuff, is modafinil, which basically is just something to keep you alert. And that's a performance-enhancing drug. And there's no question that people have tried alcohol, and you didn't mention LSD, but that's certainly something that was very popular in the 60s as an attempt at reaching a kind of creativity.
They're just not precise yet.
These are not precise tools, and they have side effects, and you know, there are reasons to not do them too, but they have been used in that capacity for a long time. The weirdest idea that leads me to think about, though, is you can actually disinhibit parts of the brain with a technique called TMS. And I suppose some brain people...
Does it hurt? What
people,
is it?
It's transcranial magnetic stimulation. It doesn't hurt. You can selectively impair certain parts of the brain for a moment. You sort of you stun a part of the brain. The problem is it's kind of crude. So we don't know that much about the brain anatomy, and we don't have that precise calibration over the stunning that you're doing relative to a particular individual's brain. So your brain and my brain are shaped a little bit differently, and I think it's risky. In small doses, it seems to be fine. I wouldn't personally want to be a subject
really?
In it. But
you're not a Dr. Jekyll in this?
That's not my thing. I'm a wimp. But some, you know, people have experimented with it, and I could imagine some interesting creativity experiments that could be done or maybe have been.
Another science fiction story just occurred to me as a result of that. We talk all the time about how creative children are, small children, and the conventional wisdom is that from between 5 and 16, the creativity is sort of whipped out of them. You study child development. Is this true? Are children naturally more creative?
I think it goes back again a little bit to how you count creativity. So I think that 5-year-olds are less inhibited, and that means that they will explore more possibilities, but they won't have the skill set necessarily to bring those things to fruition. I went to a summer camp for basically a rock and roll summer camp called Day Jams.
When you were a child?
Recently. Recently, when I was an adult learning to play guitar. And originally the idea was that I was just going to watch, but the director of the camp said, why don't you, you know, play in a band? You'll learn a lot more that way about, you know, what the kids are really like. And so I joined a band with 11-year-olds, and we kind of divided up the labor. They had faster fingers, and they kind of figured out the riffs. And I assembled the song. I sort of understood the holistic structure of a song better than they did. They didn't really understand that part. And so we did, in fact, collaborate, and I think the song came out okay. You can listen to it on my webpage under garymarcus.com/rushhour.
School of Rock 3. Gary Marcus, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Gary Marcus is the author of Guitar Zero, as well as the book Kluge, The Haphazard Evolution of the Human Mind. He's a professor at New York University.